It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Late last year, a young woman went viral on TikTok for crying about her new job, her first out of college.
I get on the train at 7:30 and I don't get home till like 6:15 earliest. And then like, I don't have time to do anything. I want to shower, eat my dinner and go to sleep. I don't have time or energy to cook my dinner either. Like, I don't have energy to work out. Like, that's out the window. Like, I'm so upset. Oh my God. The 9-to-5 schedule in general is crazy.
Some commenters called the young woman spoiled. Others said she had a point. A recent Pew survey found that just 40% of Americans between 18 and 29 have positive views of capitalism. The next oldest age range were only a little more likely to feel good about it. Our next guest says the economic realities faced by recent generations may be a big part of the story. The share of the country's GDP that goes to workers' pay is historically low. Homes, historically unaffordable. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Has your experience in the working world left you disillusioned with working, with business, with American capitalism? How does it serve workers? How does it leave workers out? Are there changes you'd like to see? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Heather Long is a columnist and member of the Washington Post editorial board and their former U.S. economics correspondent. Heather, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, it's great to be here.
You linked in a recent piece to this Pew survey, and it's interesting. It's a pretty, it looks like a stairwell, American attitudes toward capitalism. The younger you are, the less you like it. What do you see when you look at those numbers?
I mean, it's pretty astonishing when you first look at it to see so many Americans, particularly in the millennial and Gen Z, who really aren't happy. Now, people immediately will email me. I had a lot of older readers who emailed me like, well, so what do these people want to do? Go live in Russia or Cuba? And, you know, realistically, I don't think that they're clamoring for that version of communism or socialism. But I do think people are very frustrated with the current system, and not just in the funny way. I know you played that one clip of the young woman saying, I don't have enough time, you know, do my hair care, do my exercise. But I look at this through an economic lens. I'm a data nerd, and that there is some validity to these people who are upset, young people. And basically the millennials have been dubbed the unluckiest generation. Now, this is a generation that had a great growing up in the 80s and 90s, and then boom, 9/11 hits. Just as they're coming out of college or coming out of high school, we have the great financial crisis. So many people, you know, 10% unemployment rate, a lot of people not being able to get a foothold into the working world at all, or if they were, it was sort of menial jobs and retail and whatnot. Then you just, when people think they finally got something going in the end of the 2010s, boom, the pandemic hits. Once again, millions of people are out of work. Everything's getting shaken up. Then, of course, we go into the inflation crises. And so, you know, there's some validity here that it's been very, very hard, statistically harder for millennials and Gen Z to get their financial life and their career life going than any other recent generation or really anyone alive today.
Right. And when we think about milestones that are related to our economic well-being, that might be getting that first real job or getting married, buying a house, all these things. It seems like with that list of events you just mentioned, a lot of people, it's like that, you know, the mirage in the desert. Those things you think you're about to hit keep fading further and further off into the distance.
That's right. Obviously, millennials have been known for delaying getting married and delaying having children. And this, obviously, this is the most unaffordable time right now to buy a home since the early 1980s or late 1970s. When you compare the prices versus then, you know, you compare inflation and you also compare the mortgage rates. Obviously, mortgage rates were higher in the early 80s, but home prices were much lower. So when you actually kind of do an apples to apples comparison, it's pretty tough right now to get life started. And then on top of that, of course, college costs are higher. So if anybody's tried to get higher education, they usually saddle with some debt. And it's harder and harder to save for retirement. So you put all that together and it's pretty bleak. It was interesting. I got two, you know, there were 5,000 comments on this piece. It clearly struck a nerve, a lot of social media discussion. And I, as you might imagine, my inbox got flooded. I even got a few text messages from some friends. And there were kind of two broad reactions to it. I'll be interested in what people think on your show. And there were the people, many of whom were, let's say, over 50, who kind of said, these young people just need to get it together. You know, that this is just whining. And they just really refused to look at the data and the reality that there have been some very challenging circumstances for people under 40 in this country in the past 15 years. The other reaction was actually even more different than I was expecting. And that was people saying, yes, good article, but you left things out. Of course, people were frustrated about what they see as particularly corporations' role in climate change or the inability of the U.S. government and others to address climate worries and woes. Of course, a lot of worries about politics and what's going on with wars around the country, and also with people just feeling companies are getting bigger and more powerful, that it's kind of a David and Goliath situation, that they really, you know, it almost feels that they can't do anything to push back, whether it's companies owning all your data and tracking everywhere you're going, or whether it's a feeling that you walk into the grocery store, not only are the prices higher, but you've got the shrinkflation, what you're getting for your dollar is literally, you know, fewer cookies or fewer crackers. And so I thought that was interesting that there were kind of those two broad bucket reactions.
Talking to Heather Long from the Washington Post, looking at the younger generations, we're talking up to 40, really, Gen Z and millennials, worse attitudes toward capitalism, less approval in polls. This is showing up in the business world. Want to hear what you think, your experience at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring in a caller. Mike is with us on the road in his semi. Mike, hi.
Yeah, it's not necessarily just a young person's problem. I'm kind of frustrated with these companies that are just hiring part-time. They hire a dozen people to do the work of four people, and then they don't have to pay any benefits or even a decent wage. Before I'm semi-retired now, but I had a business of my own, and I had an 820 credit score when I was out on my own trying to put something together out there. Now, it's just not working.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. And Mike, Heather, Mike brings us to another big point in your piece about why people might be losing faith in the business world and capitalism, how businesses treat those people. Take us there.
Exactly. No, Mike hit on the perfect point. He's right, 100% right. There has been a lot of frustration and a lot of growth in gig work or contract work or independent contractor work. And part of the reason that I wrote this piece wasn't just to say that there was frustration, but to really call on business leaders. I had actually been at a dinner in early March, and all these CEOs were like, I just don't understand why people don't love capitalism, or, you know, why all these young people are so frustrated. And I kind of looked at them like, but don't you understand the relationship between workers and companies has changed dramatically in the past 50 years, particularly at big companies. And for the first time in history, or at least in recent history, more Americans do work at bigger companies than smaller mid-sized firms, which is a big change from how it used to be even in the 70s and 80s and 90s. And one of those big changes is just what Mike was driving at. It used to be, obviously, you worked at a company for many years, sometimes your whole career. You would get a pension. Many workers would get a pension at the end of that. There was a sense that the company was really kind of taking care of people a little bit more than you. And whereas now a lot of the risk is transferred to the worker, you know, and obviously if you're a gig worker or a contract worker, you don't even get any retirement money from the company. You know, you're just paid your hourly wage or your contract fee, and then you have to set up your own healthcare, your own retirement, any other benefits that you have. And even for people who are hired as a W-2 worker, who are considered a full-time on-staff worker, of course, pension plans are very few and far between these days, including in my own organization, has been phased out. And even with something like a healthcare plan, you know, there's usually different options. You have to try to figure out, you know, is my weird condition or medicine going to be covered on this new plan? So it's just become a lot harder and more confusing, even for people who supposedly have those golden benefits still.
Thanks for that call, Mike. We'll go to Tomas now in Madison. Tomas, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So I'm calling just kind of to echo the sentiment that, you know, as another millennial, I have a very deep distrust of the capitalist system, and in particular, the complicity of the political system, specifically the two-party system in the United States, and distrust a lot of the rhetoric around progressive concessions to socialist ideals, because it seems too convenient in the moment, and ultimately, don't trust the continuity of current political systems to actually make real change to that. That's incredibly necessary in multiple different factors, facets of society, maybe most importantly, environmental justice and climate change.
Tomas, thanks a lot for the call. Heather, Tomas, worried about capitalism and beyond, the system itself, it seems like.
Exactly. And that was certainly reflected in a lot of poll data, including that Pew Research data that you cited and I had cited in my piece, where there's just frustration and growing distrust of institutions generally, whether it's political institutions like Congress or the judiciary, or whether it's you know, different types of business organizations or civic organizations, and that's pervasive. And I think some of that is real in the sense that we haven't as a nation been able to deal with some of the big challenges that have been sitting in front of us for decades now, whether it's how to fix and reform Social Security so we can preserve it for future generations, such as millennials. That's one of the focuses of my piece. If you want an easy solution, why can't, and you're a business leader, why aren't you advocating for Congress to find a very simple fix to ensure that at least a secure retirement will be there for many, many people for decades to come. But he's right. Or climate change is another one that it continues to linger out there. I remember back in 2008 when I first got to Washington, D.C., both Republicans and Democrats were talking about, what if we did something like a carbon tax? Obviously, nobody likes taxes, but you know, there were actual debates and it felt like we were going to tackle some of these big problems. And sitting here 15 years later, we really don't have much of a plan.
Heather Long is with us, columnist and member of the Washington Post editorial board. She's talking with us about her recent article, Here's Why Americans Under 40 Are So Disillusioned with Capitalism. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you an American worker under 40 or thereabouts? What are your thoughts on how the world of work works for you? Do you think it's fair? Do you think things need to change? Do you worry about things like retirement looking ahead? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up the conversation about younger Americans' views on capitalism, younger, 40 and under in surveys. The minority of people in those age groups support capitalism right now or have a favorable view of it, according to Pew surveys. Heather Long is with us, columnist, member of the Washington Post editorial board, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you? Are you feeling disillusioned with the way the business world, the capitalist world works? Join in at 800-642-1234. We heard from Gary, who couldn't stay on the line. Gary says, it used to feel like everyone was working together in the company. Now it seems like it's all about the higher-ups making money and layoffs. And Heather, that ties right into a statistic you mentioned, a measure of how much of corporate profits goes to workers and how much corporate profits are going up. What do we see? Is Gary on the right track there?
Yeah, that's interesting. It's always a good gauge. I know we read the headlines, and I'm part of that news media that reports, oh, there's been all these big wage gains in the last few years. But sometimes it's helpful to step back and say, okay, how much of our national GDP, so our the economic pie, if you will, is going to workers, to their salaries and pay versus to capital? And that's a long-running statistic, and we've had it since the World War II era and all the way through. And it actually went up a little bit in the late 90s when we had a roaring economy then and a lot of wage increases. And a lot of people have been expecting it to tilt a little bit more towards workers, particularly after all these headlines we've been seeing about pay gains and union bargaining. And the reality is, Gary's got a point that it really hasn't budged. Basically, what's happened is, yes, workers have had some nice pay gains in the last 2 years, but at the same time, corporate profits have also skyrocketed. So the percent of the pie going towards workers has not increased in the way that we've seen in prior eras of prosperity. And so that's just a good gauge, to remind people that, wait a minute, things may not be quite as equal or certainly a similar dynamic to what a lot of our parents and grandparents experienced in 50s, 60s, 70s era.
Let's go back to our callers. Joanne is with us in Wisconsin Rapids. Joanne, hi.
Hi, great discussion. The thing about, healthcare, I've lived in Europe. I had to get an operation. The same operation cost here in the States at the time it was $10,000. I got the operation, same operation in Europe, Germany, for $4,000. And I was able to leave earlier than expected from the hospital. So the problem is capitalism, basically. Unfortunately, our politicians are telling us that Social Security is not going to be there for us, so we're not expecting it. So if you brainwash us like that, we're basically going to accept what it is and not fight against it.
Joanne, thanks for the call. I think Germans would consider themselves to have capitalism, Heather, but a different sort of attitude towards social safety nets. So did you hear, including in the comments on your article, did you hear sort of compare and contrast with, say, Western European economies?
Yeah, Rob, I think you're 100% right. That's what I told CEOs when they would say to me, well, do all these young people just want socialism or communism, is I think what most people are envisioning, and you can see in a lot of the comments on the article, is something more like a European style system where there is a bigger safety net, where there are better healthcare outcomes in many countries for a lower cost, as Joanne was just pointing out. And certainly where there are better pension and retiree benefits than broadly what we're seeing in the United States for the population as a whole. So, yeah, I think you're right that that's what most people think would be a better outcome. How do you get there? My proposal in my column is really to start with shoring up Social Security so that we can tell people like Joanne, it will be there for you.
Joanne, thanks for the call. Jay joins us now in Milwaukee. Jay, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. For me, there are two different types of capitalism. One, until the mid-80s, that was true capitalism. Then the whole Reagan administration, the whole Clinton administration, it went all berserk. Everybody has to end up making money hand on fist, and it was just crazy. We have billionaires. We are going to have trillionaires very soon, and the minimum wage is still there.
Jay, thanks a lot for the call. Heather, I've seen other people make that observation that something big changed in the 80s and as Jay said, through into the 90s, where you start to see wage gaps growing, that share of worker part of the GDP going down. Is Jay onto something? Were there significant policy changes then?
Yes, you can definitely point to a number of significant policy changes. You see a big decline in unionization starting in the 80s and early 90s. Obviously, in the 90s, you start to see global trade opening up. The economy becomes more relentlessly focused on low costs and efficiencies. You also have a big change in tax policy starting in the Reagan era, where the top rate on the highest earners, the wealthiest in the country, comes down quite dramatically during that period. And the last aspect, which I think probably gets the too little attention, is you have a massive explosion starting in the early 80s of the financial sector. So the financial sector has just become more and more of a dominant part of the U.S. economy than it used to be. Banking used to be kind of a boring profession, and then you start to get those, I don't know if you'd call it Wild West, but you certainly start to get a lot more financial securitization and innovation and all these sorts of things, and bigger and bigger banks and bigger risk-taking.
And Heather, just in our last minute or so, you mentioned meeting with some business leaders who are talking about these issues. Is the attitude you're getting like, kids today, but whatever, we'll keep doing what we're doing? Or, this is something significant that we should really pay attention to?
I think it's starting to become something significant that people are paying attention to, which is the good sign. The bad sign is, as I point out in my piece, their conclusions about what to do about it. I wrote this piece partly in response to the BlackRock CEO, you know, one of the most powerful people on Wall Street, and he writes an annual letter, and his solution to a lot of the problems we've been discussing in the past half hour was, don't worry, we will just create a new BlackRock product to solve your retirement needs. And while I think he was trying to be good-hearted, it just comes off as, wow, that sounds like you're just going to make even more money from an already broken system.
Heather, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thanks for the conversation.
That's Heather Long, columnist and member of the Washington Post editorial board. She talked with us about her recent article, the headline, Here's Why Americans Under 40 Are So Disillusioned with Capitalism. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. While visiting Wisconsin earlier this week, President Joe Biden announced a new plan to cancel some federal student loan debt for more than 30 million borrowers. It's the latest of the administration's ongoing efforts to provide some kind of student debt relief. Here's President Biden during his visit to Madison on Monday.
Today, too many Americans, especially young people, are saddled with unsustainable debts in exchange for a college degree. The ability for working and middle-class folks to repay their student loans has become so burdensome that a lot can't repay it for even decades after being in school. And I mean that sincerely. Many of you know that sitting in front of me. Even when they have worked hard and pay their student loans, their debt increases, not diminishes. Too many people feel the strain and stress, wondering if they're going to get married, have their first child, start a family, because even if they get by, they still have this crushing, crushing debt.
Some past efforts have been struck down by the U.S. Supreme Court. An expert on higher education finance is here now to help us break down the new plans, how likely they are to go into effect, and who might get some kind of relief if they do. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have student loan debt? A significant amount? Are you having trouble paying off your loans? Have you benefited from any of the recent student loan relief efforts from over the last year, like the SAVE plan? What questions do you have about the state of student loans in the U.S.? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Nick Hillman is a professor in the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis at the UW-Madison School of Education. He's director of the Student Success Through Applied Research, or STAR Lab. Nick, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for the invitation, Rob.
Having a little bit of deja vu, Nick, talking to you about the latest Biden administration plan on student loan debt. Talk us through what this newest proposal would actually do.
Yeah, we talked in the fall about the Biden administration's efforts to cancel student loan debt broadly. And fast forward to this spring, I suppose, and that plan got scuttled by the Supreme Court. So the Biden administration has gone to plan B. And this new one uses a little bit of a different strategy, different legal strategy, but also has a little bit more targeted beneficiaries in mind. And so that's what this new plan is about. It's a second attempt at this.
Now let's talk, this is a little weedsy here, but the legal strategy, this is important because if the Biden administration does it wrong, it could be struck down in the courts. What, and you've had to turn into sort of an expert on the legal system on this, Nick. What are they doing differently that makes them think this might pass court muster?
I tried my best, and I'm still learning a lot about the legal angles here. But basically, the first round of this, the Biden administration tried to use the HEROES Act. The HEROES Act was their legal kind of framework, and the Supreme Court said that did not give the U.S. Department of Education authority to cancel debt. And so they said, you can't do it through the HEROES Act. So the Biden administration in this one, this round two effort, is not using the HEROES Act. It's using the Higher Education Act. The Higher Education Act has been around since 1965, and it has some language in there that says that the Department of Education and the Secretary of Education can waive and modify student loan programs. And so I'm sure there's a lot more to it than that, but that's basically the gist of it.
Okay, and now let's get into what this would do, assuming it passes any legal challenges. As you mentioned, these are more targeted types of relief. What are some of the targets here?
Well, there are five different groups of borrowers who are kind of in mind here. And so I'll try to run through them briefly. But basically, all of this is going to affect probably about half of all student loan borrowers. So if you have a student loan, there's a good chance that this plan, if implemented, would affect you. So the five groups, you got one group of borrowers, the sort of most obvious one, the ones who have been repaying their loans for 20 to 25 years. That's a large group, about 2.5 million people there. But then you have this group of borrowers who owe more today than when they originally borrowed. And so their debt wouldn't be canceled, but the accumulated interest, the interest sort of that has made their balloons, payments balloon and sort of run away, as the Biden administration says, they would have the interest forgiven. And so there's about 23 million people would benefit from that one. So those are the first two groups, 20 years or 25 years in repayment, and those who have their sort of runaway interest accumulating over the years. But there are three other groups here that I think are really interesting, and the Biden administration is going to provide more details about going forward. The first one, the third one here is borrowers who were in low-value programs that didn't pay off. And another group is borrowers who are facing financial hardship or are at risk of defaulting on their loans. And then the final group are borrowers who are eligible for existing programs but just are not enrolled in them. And so the Department of Education is kind of taking different strategies to try to help all five of those groups of borrowers.
I want to dig into that low-value concept a little more. These are people who maybe went to a college. Often these, I think, were for-profit colleges that then administration said, hey, these aren't really doing anything. These aren't legitimate schools. They end up being losing their eligibility for federal financial aid. And there have been some high-profile closures of some of these for-profit chains. Is that what we're talking about there?
That's exactly correct. And the Biden administration has been making a lot of efforts to improve the marketplace here, try to regulate these low-value programs. And they've been met with a lot of legal challenges over the years. And so it's really interesting to see how they're going to approach it this time around. But we'll get more details on what exactly counts as a low-value program when the Biden administration releases their specific details here.
Talking to Nick Hillman, higher education expert at UW-Madison, looking at the latest effort at student loan debt relief from the Biden administration. You just heard the basics there. What do you think? Are you in one of those categories that Nick just listed? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Mary Kay is with us in Kenosha. Mary Kay, hi.
Hi, I know two families that live with other people because they can't afford rent. They either have to pay, and some don't even have a car. One doesn't even have a car, but they have to go to work, two jobs. These are the kind of people that are homeless that should have their student loans waived.
Mary Kate, thanks for the call. And Nick, that sounds like people experiencing financial hardships. I'm quoting from one of those categories you just listed. We don't know the exact story of Mary Kay's acquaintances, but that seems to fit the bill.
It sure does. And I think what's really important to consider is that the amount of resources, the amount of money and time that the U.S. Department of Education spends on collecting loans from the, you know, story that we just heard from the caller, that amount of effort sometimes isn't really worth it. And the Biden administration is saying it's just easier to just cancel that debt. Oftentimes it's maybe $5,000 to $10,000 in student loan debt, which in the grand scheme of things might be worth it to just try to call it good and just let them go from their debts so they can move on with their lives.
Mary Kay, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. As we heard in that clip earlier from President Biden, Biden's making the argument that this is an economic issue. This is holding people back from participating in the economy in some ways, doing things like finding housing, making major purchases, things like that. Do we know what kind of impact these kinds of college loan debts can have on people?
That's a great question. And that's really the mystery here, because there are so many possible answers to that question. There's just not enough strong academic research to really say with a lot of confidence exactly what's going to happen. But I would say probably a couple different things. Yes, there would be a stimulative effect. There's some good evidence that when borrowers have had their loans forgiven, that that they've been able to save and their credit scores improve. I mean, those are kind of like mechanical things, like you would expect those to happen. And that's a good thing. But we also don't know nearly enough about the psychological kind of, challenges that having debt loom over you for years does have. And so there's probably a lot that we just don't know yet that we will certainly find out. But I do think that there are some economic benefits here, some economic potentially big impacts, but also think about the psychological ones and everything in between, I'm sure, is on the table. It's just really, really hard to know for certain, that it's the loans that are causing all of these negative issues.
Let's go back to our callers. Shane is with us in Madison. Shane, hi.
Hi. My partner and I both have student loan debt balances that are higher than they were originally, and so we've been paying them down over the years, and mostly those payments have gone towards the interest. If student loan debt interest is forgiven, do you know if there's any information as to whether previous payments towards the interest will be counted towards the principal, or if they're just kind of wasted, for lack of a better term?
Shane, thanks for the call. Nick, how retroactive, I guess, would this be?
I don't know that. In fact, I don't know that that's been talked about at all, really. I do know something, though, that might be helpful context and relevant. One thing is that the Biden administration aims to make these changes automatic. And so they say that, you know, borrowers don't need to apply or don't need to opt in. They'll just sort of automatically sort of readjust accordingly. What the Biden administration has done in the past, though, they've made some modifications to some of the rules that do retroactively count payments. So kind of like the way that the caller just described, I'm not saying that that's what's going to happen in this situation, but there have been some instances where they have done some retroactive changes that sort of give you credits for things that you've done in the past. Now, whether that's going to be the case with this one, I don't know.
Shane, thanks a lot for that call. Nick Hillman is with us, professor in the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis at UW-Madison School of Education, talking about the Biden administration's newest student debt relief plan, how it might affect some borrowers. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you or a family member been having difficulty repaying student loans? Has it affected your ability to afford a milestone, a car, house, having kids? Does it make you feel like the college degree wasn't worth it in the first place? Join in with your thoughts or your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our conversation with Nick Hillman, professor in the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis at UW-Madison's School of Education, looking at the Biden administration's newest student debt relief plan. President Biden announced it during a visit to Wisconsin on Monday. Let's go back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Angie is with us in Racine. Angie, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to share that my husband and I both had student loans for quite some time. I was fortunate when COVID happened to have the rest of my loans forgiven through the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program, but only after it was revamped. I wasn't eligible for in the initial 10-year forgiveness program. But my husband has been paying on, we've been paying on his loans for close to, I don't know, 15, 16 years. We have about 10 more years to go. And it has been a financial hardship for us and has limited what we can do for our family because of how long it's taken.
And Angie, can I ask what line of work are you in that made you eligible ultimately for the public service loan forgiveness program?
So I've always worked for the state of Wisconsin. So it was, I didn't have the right type of loan for the initial 10 years, even though I applied for it and had been a public servant for 10 years. And then when COVID happened, they revamped the public service loan forgiveness program, and that's how eventually my loans were forgiven.
Got it, Angie. Thanks a lot for the call. Nick, there was a lot of reporting, including from NPR, on, you know, a lot of people were close to eligible for the public service loan forgiveness programs that were out there. But there were lots of little fine prints and exceptions and things like that, as in Angie's case, that made them not eligible. How much has that changed, as she mentioned, with changes during COVID?
It's changed remarkably. The NPR investigation, as you mentioned, they were one of the first to show that the U.S. Department of Education was only approving about 1% of the applications that came through these public service loan forgiveness programs. And so the Biden administration has really made an effort to simplify the process and make the administration of it work better. So little things that you would think don't matter, but they're huge. They're really important bureaucratic hurdles, like getting your employer to certify that you are employed for the year for a public or nonprofit organization. The Biden administration has found ways to streamline that process for people so they could participate at higher rates. Angie mentioned that they didn't have the right type of loan. And I think that that is a really important piece of this too. If you have loans that qualify for these programs, then you're in. But if you don't, you can consolidate those loans in some cases to those eligible programs. And so if you go to studentaid.gov, they can give you more information, or if you talk to a servicer, they can tell you more about how to go about consolidating loans over into the direct loan programs that make you eligible for these benefits.
Thanks for that call. Jeff joins us now in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Hi, good afternoon, Rob. I have an opinion on this. I graduated from a university where I had debt, and I worked after graduation. I paid off my federal loans. In my opinion, the way things are now, we need people in the military. We need people in our national parks working and cleaning and maintaining those parks. There are ways that people could work off their debt by being a federal employee or, volunteering with AmeriCorps or something like that. I think whatever debt they have, they should work to pay it off.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Nick, some of those public service loans are along those lines. Are there other things or other proposals to do what Jeff's talking about?
Well, I think the public service loan forgiveness is the main one. There are, in addition to these federal programs, there are, state programs, or sometimes individual colleges have programs that kind of are tailored for special services or public services, even beyond what the federal programs are for. So you see kind of a variety of options out there. But I think the caller is onto something. I mean, there is definitely, these design features to these programs. Like, why do we have it be 10 years of service? Why isn't it 5 years of service? And why isn't it, this particular income threshold that's eligible, or that particular income threshold? So these things are always negotiated politically, and there are design features of these programs that can really, change over time. And so I think that that's what I hear in the caller's question too.
Thanks for the call, Jeff. Barry is with us now in Madison. Barry, hello.
Hello, good afternoon. With all of the students in Wisconsin and across the country that are buried in debt, we don't have a long-term for the kids that are going into debt now as students. If you turn the clock back to the about 2005, 2010, the state of Wisconsin and most states were really pumping a lot of money into university education. And I believe it was about 2010 that there were hundreds of millions of dollars cut for the university's budget.
Barry, gotcha. Thanks for the call. Your call's breaking up a little bit there. But Nick, it takes us to the question of why is college costing so much? Barry pointing toward a cut in state and in some cases, I think, federal funding for higher education. What's been going on?
Definitely, this is all connected to those public funding trends. But one way I think about this is we have two different problems that I think policymakers are trying to wrestle with. And this image might not—it's not really the best image, but think about falling into a river and then sort of struggling to get out of that river. And so sometimes we want to prevent people from falling in the first place. And that's where I think the caller's points are coming in. Like, let's keep funding for our public education systems high so that we can prevent people from borrowing in the first place. And then the other side of the coin here, the other side of the stream, I suppose, is that once somebody is in the stream and they're sort of struggling to get out, what are those life rafts and what are the ways that we can try to get people out of the problems that they're potentially in? And so definitely it's a complex problem to solve that you have to take multiple angles in, and public subsidies is one of them.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Nick Hillman from the UW School of Education, UW-Madison, looking at the latest proposal from the Biden administration offering some measures of student debt relief, more targeted than some of the past efforts. Back to your calls. Shaylin is with us in Buffalo City. Shaylin, hi.
Hey, so I hear this is doing a lot of great things for borrowers from the past, but what is this going to do for future borrowers? What do our children have to look forward to out of this bill?
Shaylin, thanks for the call. Great question, Nick. My understanding is not much out of this particular measure.
I think that's probably true. I think that there are definitely borrowers like the ones who have been in repayment for 20 to 25 years. That's kind of not who you're talking about. But there are some fixes here that I think could potentially help borrowers in the future. It might not reduce overall borrowing, but they do set up a framework to help make the systems work a little bit better for borrowers and for some degree of relief for borrowers. And in addition to the five groups that we've been talking about, the Biden administration has also implemented this SAVE program. And Rob, you mentioned it early on the call, but it kind of sets up a new framework for how loan repayment works. And as long as people opt in and sort of participate in the SAVE program, there could be potential benefits for incoming students and students long into the future.
Yeah, thanks for that call. I was hoping to bring that up. Can you talk a little more about that SAVE program? We've mentioned in past discussions, what should people be looking at if they're going into college or there now?
I think there are probably two pieces to this one. One of them is that if you have federal loans that qualify, these direct loans, you'll have the possibility to have a degree of your debt forgiven for each additional year that you are in repayment. So after 10 years, they'll cancel a certain portion of your debt. I believe it is up to $12,000. If you're in repayment for 11 years, it'll be like $13,000. There's sort of like a tiered system here that this new SAVE program is designed to sort of help with earlier relief. But the other part to the SAVE program that I think is pretty interesting is that it's designed to prevent that runaway interest that we were talking about earlier, the ballooning interest that happens with a lot of these programs. And these programs are designed to be sort of upside down in this way. And so the SAVE program is designed to not do that. It's designed to keep interest rates down. It's designed for payments to not balloon over time.
And Nick, in our last minute or so, when could these new proposals go into effect and eligible people start to see a change?
The short answer is this fall, potentially. And the longer answer is that there are still a couple of steps that the U.S. Department of Education has to go through. They have to formally announce what the plans are. They have to then allow some period of time for public comment. And then the Biden administration, the Department of Education, can implement those rules. So that's going to take a few months.
And then, of course, the risk of court challenges. Again, we're not lawyers. Do you think this might have a better chance of passing muster than ones that have been struck down in the past?
I do, for just a general naive optimism. But also, I do think that the strategy here and the more tailored efforts are probably going to make it more challenging to have people claim that they are harmed by these programs.
Nick, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure, Rob. Take care.
That's Nick Hillman, professor in the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis at the UW-Madison School of Education, also director of the Student Success through Applied Research Lab. We talked to him today about the Biden administration's newly announced student debt relief plan and how it might affect borrowers. You can keep sharing your stories about the impact of student loan debt in your life, and maybe your questions that we can tackle, hand over to our news department, maybe to investigate a little more. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. And thanks for all your calls today. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, check out the latest efforts to boost literacy around Wisconsin. Talk to a couple groups about the efforts they're making in different communities around the state. Maybe share your own stories. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Tomorrow on Food Friday, we're going to change things up. Usually we get advice on how to cook, but tomorrow we'll get advice on how not to cook. We're inviting you to share your stories. We'll share some of ours here from WPR about cooking gone wrong. The mistake that ruined a dish, the experiment that didn't come out right, the assumption that had a bad outcome for you and umption. You can get us started right now. Send us an email with the story of your cooking mistake. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. We'll share stories and commiserate and hey, maybe learn some lessons. That's tomorrow on Food Friday. Mistakes? I've made a few. This is Central Time. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. The spring migration season is coming up here in Wisconsin. Birdcast reports that over 7 million birds flew over Wisconsin last night. During peak migration, that gets up to 12 million birds. Our next guest says that birds are more than just a natural wonder. They can teach us how to pay attention to and take care of the world around us and the people around us. She's with us now to talk about her new memoir, which tells the story of how she and her neighbors found community through birds and worked together to protect a Wisconsin park. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you like bird watching? Has it ever inspired you to take a closer look at the world around you? Have you ever been involved in local conservation efforts to protect local parks and wildlife spaces? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Trish O'Kane is a former journalist, an environmental educator, and a senior lecturer at the University of Vermont. She created the Birding to Change the World Service Learning Course and Program at UW-Madison while completing her doctorate. Her new book is called Birding to Change the World, a memoir. Trish, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. It's an honor to be on your show.
You did not grow up planning to be a bird watcher or a bird enthusiast. How did you get your start in bird watching? It came at a difficult time in your life just after Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans.
That's right. People who knew me 25 years ago, 30 years ago, when I was a human rights journalist in Central America, would probably laugh if they knew now I was teaching ornithology. I'm an accidental ornithologist and an accidental teacher as well. It was in New Orleans teaching at Loyola University when Hurricane Katrina hit, and our home was destroyed, our neighborhood was destroyed, many people drowned. And, you know, I was really distraught, and I hadn't thought about environmental issues in any serious way before the hurricane. And suddenly, you know, nature was in my living room, so to speak. And I wanted to understand what had happened and why it had happened. I didn't understand why the levees had failed. I didn't really even understand sea level, to be honest with you. And we were living below sea level. So after the hurricane, I just started watching birds in my yard as a way to calm myself down before I went to go teach, because it was difficult teaching in the city after the storm. But it was, I didn't have binoculars. I didn't have a field guide. I just started watching my yard birds.
Ultimately, you end up deciding, hey, I want to do more of this environmental stuff. You apply at a graduate program in a place called Wisconsin. You've been living in New Orleans. You're in Central America. you had certain reservations about coming up here. What were they?
Well, first of all, I didn't know anything about Wisconsin, the geography. I knew it was cold, right? That was it. Like, my vision of Wisconsin was, you know, being buried in a blizzard under, you know, 6 feet of snow or something. Sort of a nightmare, a very an ignorant stereotype. But UW-Madison had an excellent, one of the best in the country, environmental studies program that allowed me at 45 to take my social science background. I had two master's degrees in social science, zero in environmental science. I hadn't taken biology since the eighth grade. But UW-Madison accepted the social science background and allowed me to do a PhD in environmental natural resources. And I took basically 4 years of undergraduate ecology, biology, every science-ology you can think of, including ornithology. And so the school was so good, and also it was so beautiful when I came up. I quickly, you know, got over my reservations about the weather, although the first winter was the worst that Wisconsin had had in a century. So if it hadn't been for the birds and my birding class, which forced me outside in the winter, I don't know if I would have made it through the first year, to be honest with you.
And you formed a connection with your local park. It's Warner Park. Not one that I think, if people don't know Madison, it's not maybe at the top of people's list for a nature type of right. park. There's a lot of recreation there. What was it that led you to have this connection and find such a rich natural part of this city park?
Right. Well, first of all, when we moved up from New Orleans, my husband and I, we wanted to get a house, and the only place we could afford was on the north side, and it was beautiful. We loved it. It reminded us of Louisiana because it was a wetland park, right? Warner had a wetland, and we bought a little house right across the street. It was 5 miles from the university. But I had no idea what was in the park. Again, I didn't come to Madison as an ornithologist or even a birder. I just enrolled in an ornithology class. It was fantastic. And the professor, Dr. Mark Barris, said, every week, go somewhere for 1 hour and sit and watch the birds or walk around and, you know, identify them. And I thought, that park's across the street from my house. I'll just go in there. There has to be some birds in there. So I ended up spending hours and hours in there every day. And over the course of my PhD work in 5 years, I found 141 species, over half of them long distance migrators that went to Central America or South America or the Deep South in the wintertime. And since I left Madison in 2015 to come to Vermont for a job, Wild Warner, the group that protects Warner Park now, has found 178 species. They have added to my original list. So even though there are a lot of recreation facilities in that park, it's an amazing example of how we can share this planet with other species, how we can coexist. And that was the question really I left New Orleans with when I was, you know, in deep grief and really distraught, thinking, we're going to destroy this planet. We do not know how to, I don't know how to live on it. I just, you know, moved into a place below sea level. My home was destroyed. My neighbors got drowned and I have no clue how to live. And I moved to Madison and here's this park with a baseball stadium, with parking lots, with tennis courts, with all kinds of sports facilities, but it also has wild meadows and a wetland and 178 species of birds, including eagles now nesting on the Marsh Island that used to be blown up during Rhythm and Booms.
A big fireworks show. This is a part of one of your main themes in the book, if I'm reading it right, Trish, that we sometimes think, okay, this is human development area and nature. Well, this is the thing we're doing what we can to preserve completely free of human impact. There's a lot more in our backyards than we might realize. That's worth protecting.
Right. Well, I think, you know, in our culture, it's not in all cultures, but definitely in Western industrialized cultures, we have this idea that we're separate from nature. And I had a big wall in my brain when I moved to Madison. You know, I'm separate from nature. And so the park, there are lines where the animals aren't going to cross. And I didn't think that I was going to find red-tailed hawks flying over the baseball stadium during games with freshly killed squirrels in their talons. I didn't think I was going to find red-tailed hawks mating for 30 seconds on top of the baseball stadium lights, right? I expected to find the birds and the animals only on the wilder side of the park, but they were all over the park. The animals really busted down that separation in my brain and opened my way of thinking. And nature is everywhere, including inside our homes. We're sharing our lives with nature all the time and with wild creatures and microscopic creatures. And we just don't realize it or see it or see them.
Talking to Trish O'Kane about her new book, Birding to Change the World. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Trish, you ultimately went on to do this program, Birding to Change the World. It brought university students together with kids in the community. What inspired this? What were you hoping to do?
Right. Well, that was another happy accident. I have no children. I had no experience with children. I never planned to teach children. I wanted to get a PhD to teach college students. But when I started birding in Warner Park and discovered what an amazing birding hotspot it is and what an important place for birds migrating from the south to the north and further north, and also a summer nesting ground, I was amazed. And then I discovered that the city had plans to further build on the park and pave parts of it and cut down some of the woods and turn part of the wetland into a pontoon concession. And I knew I'd been studying ecology then a couple of years, and I knew that would really hurt the birds. So I was very alarmed. I started going to neighborhood meetings. And somewhere in the middle of all this, I talked to the city councilor. She's now the mayor, but at that time it was Satya Rhodes Conway for my district. And she said, look, she said, you're a graduate student. You're studying ecology. And there's hundreds of kids living in apartments around Warner Park, and they have no yards. The park is their yard, but there's no environmental programs in the park. So, you know, instead of just complaining about city plans, why don't you do something for your community? And she challenged me, and she was right. And so I set up a class at UW-Madison. I was a graduate student. The Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies supported me. And I started teaching undergraduates and taking them every week to Sherman Middle School, which is 1 mile from Warner Park. And we had a walking field trip to Warner Park. Each of my students was paired with a child for the entire semester. That started in 2010. It's still running in Madison, not exactly in the same way and not at Sherman Middle School, but the program's still going. It's taught by someone I trained. And then I duplicated the program here in Vermont. And Brown University in Rhode Island has also replicated the program in Providence. And it's a wild success. The schools love it. The kids love it. Parents love it. The community loves it. And it brings college students into neighborhoods. And so kids also get to think about going to college. And college is an accessible goal. It's not just about birds. It's about relationships between people.
Trish O'Kane is with us. Her new book is Birding to Change the World, a memoir. It tells, in part, the story of a Wisconsin community that came together to save a local park and a wider story of creating connections through a shared love of the natural world. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you love about birds? Do you have a magical spot in your community where you see lots of different birds? Have you worked with members of your own neighborhood to preserve maybe that very spot? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with environmental educator Trish O'Kane about her new book, Birding to Change the World, a memoir. What we can learn from our feathered friends about environmental stewardship and civic action. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a gateway bird, a portal bird, one that got you interested in bird watching? Do you have a favorite place to spend time watching birds and other wildlife in the state? Do you like to stop, slow down, and watch what's going on around you? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Kathleen is with us in Madison. Kathleen, hi.
Hi. It's great hearing Trish on the radio. I met her when I moved to the same neighborhood in 2013, and I started just expanding my whole world by going across the street to Warner Park, and it has become my my living room, my grocery store, and my church. I spend a lot of time in there.
And are you involved, Kathleen, in some of the preservation efforts there?
Yeah. So for the past 3 or 4 years, I was the president of Wild Warner, and now I've turned to becoming the volunteer coordinator. And just incredible things are happening in this park. We've got the first thing that I thought was really cool as president, I made an emphasis on trying to keep the beavers in the park without any conflicts with human interests. And we did that. For 4 years, we had a beaver family. Just no problems. We figured out how to keep them from damming and from chewing on trees, and they were just this great influence on the park.
Kathleen, thanks a lot for sharing that. Trish, Kathleen mentioned Wild Warner. You were heavily involved with that in your time. You write about that a lot in the book. Can you talk about that community of people that came together, of people who loved, as Kathleen did, this the wildlife of this park to try to protect it?
Yes. Well, first of all, I want to thank Kathleen for calling in. She's one of my sheroes. And, you know, my husband and I left Madison, and it was people like Kathleen who kept the group going so strong. The park looks better than when I left. I cried when I saw it a couple of weeks ago when I was in Madison at the book festival. So Kathleen's an example of what someone can do. And I remember when she came to one of our first meetings, and she talked about making cookies from flour made from the cattails, and she taught people how to do it. She made the cookies and gave them to us. They were delicious. I mean, she's an incredibly creative educator and organizer. I admire her very much. So when we moved to Madison, Rob, I discovered through my dissertation, I started doing research on the environmental history of Warner Park and just talking to neighbors and you know, having conversations with them and walking through the park with them. And I discovered that there had been people who for decades had been trying to protect the park. And so every 10 years or so, there'd be a push to develop or build or destroy something, and people would rise up. Now, they never formally, there was a group. It wasn't a formal group. They called themselves the Wild Ones. And that was in the late 70s, and it was mostly senior citizens. And they organized themselves, but there was never a formal group. So my husband and I, we called a meeting of neighbors at our dining room table. I think it was in 2009, September 2009. 8 people showed up. I baked 2 apple pies, and that's how Wild Warner started, the group that Kathleen led for 3 or 4 years. And now she's leading dozens and dozens of volunteers from the community to plant trees and do all kinds of really cool things in Warner Park.
Kathleen, thanks a lot for the call. We're talking to Trish O'Kane about her new book, Birding to Change the World, a memoir. Back to your calls. David is with us in South Milwaukee. David, hi.
Hey, Rob. Hey. So what really got me fascinated with birds is that in Warnemont Park in Cudahy, which is just south of the city of Milwaukee, there's a colony of thousands of bank swallows that breeds there, and they dig burrows into the sides of the bluffs. And when you see it, you just would never, ever guess that you were in Wisconsin. And it's just an incredible sight. And also, like, there are these tiny little birds, and they migrate all the way from South America. So I just think it's just one of those things that, you know, you would just never expect to see here so close to the city of Milwaukee.
David, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. Trish, a lot of people, I think, have their entry bird, the gateway bird that opens their eyes to a whole new world. Can you talk about that a little?
Yes. Well, I love, thank you, David, for the story about the bank swallows. There are swallows in Warner Park, too. And it's so important that you notice that species and that you love them and that you broadcast this, because swallows are insect eaters, as you know, aerial insectivores. They hunt on the wing, and all insect-eating birds, which is most birds, are in serious trouble. Their numbers are dropping because we're losing our insect populations. So people, if you love birds, you got to love the bugs. I was sort of a classic screamer whenever I saw a spider or any kind of bug. And I lived in Central America, and there were some really obnoxious big cockroaches there. But after I started birding and I took entomology, because the birds eat bugs, I figure I better study some bugs too. Completely changed how I see insects, learning what they do, the jobs they do, how they support our whole food web. Yes.
David, thanks a lot for the call. Trish, an important thing to you, and this comes up again and again in your book, is making sure the benefits of nature and birding are available to everybody, and they are not. We've had high-profile incidents of racial profiling of people birding. What kind of things are you hoping to see change?
Well, I think a lot is changing because of birders of color are fomenting a powerful, peaceful revolution. I really was deeply impacted by the work of Dr. Drew Lanham, who's an African-American avian ecologist at Clemson University. And anybody you want to see what he's done, just Google his name and look up, I think it's 9 Rules for the Black Bird Watcher, and it's a very powerful YouTube about birding and racism. So there's all kinds of books coming out. There's all kinds of new birding clubs forming, birders of color, feminist book clubs. It's a very exciting time to be in the birding world. But I think we can't ignore the fact that in our country, for a lot of people, this country is a war zone. I mean, there are people who are terrified of this, our security forces. And I used to work as a human rights journalist in Central America, monitoring security forces who were murdering people. And I come back to my own country and find that a lot of, not all police are bad, but a lot of police and different police forces, including in Burlington where I live, have a serious bias problem against people of color. And it's one thing to have biases. We all have them. It's another thing to have biases and be carrying a gun.
And Trish, on a lighter note, to wrap up with, you were just back in Wisconsin. What were some of the birds you're hoping to see? Maybe what are some of the birds that come through Wisconsin do you miss now that you're over in Vermont?
Oh, Rob, I cried when I saw the sandhill cranes in Warner Park, because we do not have sandhill cranes. And I mean, when I taught in Warner Park, the kids, when they saw those cranes, they just stopped and stared like as if they were in church or something, because the cranes were bigger than them. And so I miss the cranes. I miss the way they bugle, the duet. I miss how when their chicks would hatch, and they're called colts, and they would walk, parade them around the park. That is a bird I will always, always miss.
Trish, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Rob. Enjoyed talking to you. I miss Wisconsin.
That's Trish O'Kane, former journalist, current environmental educator, senior lecturer at the University of Vermont. She is with us today to share some insights from her new book. It's called Birding to Change the World, a memoir. A lot of Wisconsin in that book, as you heard, including her efforts to preserve Warner Park and all the bird species that show up there in Madison's north side. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, writer Anne Lamott is back with us to share her new book. It's called Somehow, Thoughts on Love. And on this week's edition of Food Friday, How Not to Cook, we'll ask for your biggest cooking mistakes and what you learned from them, whether it was your first cooking effort or your last one, something you did last night. You can get us started right now, by the way. You can email ideas@wpr.org. Again, share that cooking gone wrong story. Email ideas@wpr.org. Then join that conversation. It's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.